The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program, and I am David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in today, and great to be here. And Jim Muncy is with us, a great guest. So a couple of quick pointers. We're doing the full-length show, maybe a little longer, but I'm only going to thank our sponsors. I want to spend the maximum amount of time talking with Jim, so I'm going to avoid reading sponsor messages later in the show. But if you would like to call and talk to Jim Muncy today, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Be patient. Let it ring, and we'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. You can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, or use our blog on our website. If you need to know how to do that, please email me, and I'll send you a quick set of instructions. And then as soon as today's show ends, I will upload the weekly website newsletter, and it will show you everything current for the coming week, plus all of the programs we have booked in through the end of the year. We still have openings left in November and December. And if you have guest suggestions for us, please don't hesitate to email me and let me know who they are. Again, drspace at thespaceshow.com. Remember, all of our programs are archived, and you can listen off of our website or very rapidly download them. Check out our store. We're coming up on the holiday season. There may be some great gift ideas for your favorite Space Show listener, space advocate, space enthusiast, and that is in the upper left menu under support, and you'll see our Cafe Press store. To me, as always, the most important buttons deal with supporting the Space Show, as we are a listener-supported program and a 501c3 nonprofit with one, onegiantleapfoundation.org. Remember, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you still get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you paying taxes in California. But, of course, there are better reasons than tax savings to contribute to the Space Show. If you like our guests, do you like interacting with them, either live or on the blog, and the topics that we bring up, please help us keep doing it, because, again, we are listener-supported, and your support keeps it all happening. And we start our annual campaign around Thanksgiving time, but now's not too early, and we absolutely appreciate your support. Again, thespaceshow.com, and you'll see all of the support information for PayPal on the homepage, as well as the two Amazon programs, which are pretty cool for supporting nonprofits. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You're free to download our programs and share them, although it's far easier to send somebody a URL to our programs than the entire show. There's only a couple of simple rules. Don't do any editing or copying or anything like that, and don't post anything up on YouTube or any other websites, including your own, and also don't do anything commercial with the shows. And then finally, written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. We do thank our podcasters, and you can see all of them on our website under the instructions for listening to the Space Show, also in the upper left menu. And again, I appeal for your support, and you'll hear more about that as the shows and the weeks go on. So, Jim, well, before I do that, we do have sponsors, and they do get the banner ads running across the homepage, which they can change from time to time. And I urge you to check what's under those banner ads, because they do change their messages. But I do want to thank Northrop Grumman, AIAA, Celestis, the Space Development Network, National Space Society, the Space plan, and also the Space Foundation. Their sponsorship is very, very important to us. We would not be bringing you this show without their great help. And when you can, check out their messages and participate in their conferences and in their meetings. And we and the sponsors thank you for that. So Jim Muncy is back with us. He really needs no real introduction on the space show, because unless you're a brand new listener, you know who Jim is. But he is the president and founder of Polyspace, and this is an independent space policy consultancy to help space entrepreneurs, and others succeeding with space business, tech, and public affairs. He has commercial space as well as more traditional customers. He really knows his way around Congress and Capitol Hill and the legislatures and the administration. And it's always fabulous to have you with us again, Jim. Welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Good afternoon. Wonderful, as always, to be back with you, David. And, wow, that person sounds really important and knowledgeable. I hope I can live up to that.
I'm sure you can. I was thinking you were going to say, I'd like to meet that person. But
yeah, it would be nice to meet that person. I guess I should look in a mirror more often.
Let me ask you, we're coming up on Judgment Day for 2 years or so of the Trump administration. How do you see 2 years for space? I guess that would include establishing the National Space Council. And what do you think the next 2 years may be, especially if we have different critters controlling the House of Representatives?
Well, I wish that presidential approval numbers and congressional ballots in 2.5 weeks were all cast based on how well this administration is doing on space, because it's been just a home run on many fronts. I can remember, frankly, less than 2 years ago, even after the election, people asking questions about whether or not a space council was a good idea or not, and wasn't it hopeless, and it's always hard to try to, get all the various elephants and rhinoceroses and other assorted cabinet agencies and agencies to work together on space policy, but this administration has done it. I mean, you can say that it's a unique situation because, Trump is so forceful, or because Pence is a uniquely capable vice president. But this administration has really just accomplished a tremendous amount in terms of not so much making space policy, because you can write policy, but they've been implementing space policy. They've actually been tasking agencies to do things and making agencies do those things and implement things and change how they have been carrying out space activities, whether they're a regulatory agency or a promotional agency or an R&D agency or a procurement agency. This administration has been dramatically influencing how space is executed at the federal level. And it's amazing. It's like night and day. And it's not a partisan night and day. It's not like different than the Obama administration. It's equally different from the Bush 43 administration. The hallmark of space policies in the past is that they were observed only by happenstance. Typically, the agencies would get together and work together to create a policy, but then they would say, well, all the details will be left to implementation plans or implementation guides or whatever, which typically never showed up. So when the rubber hit the road, the policy would be tossed out the window because the agency wanted to do what the agency wanted to do. And obviously I'm mostly talking about NASA here because most of my experiences were there, but that included the Air Force or DOD or other agencies as well. And it's just the agencies are actually doing what the policies say. And that's pretty amazing for someone who, you know, puts their shoulder to the grindstone every week, every day, trying to help commercial space get through the myriad, you know, mazes and overcome the obstacles to business success in Washington. The fact that the policies are actually being implemented, that the principles of promoting commercial space are actually being lived up to, is just amazing. And I couldn't be happier with this administration on space policy. Well, I could be happier. I mean, they could cancel SLS, but they're not doing that, at least not yet. But, you know, leaving that aside, I really couldn't be happier. They're just doing a great job.
So Jim, if you are just an ordinary citizen and not necessarily a space enthusiast, and you mostly hear about the resistance and the lack of anything that's bipartisan and the animosity between both sides and on and on and on, and then they happen to tune this in by happenstance and they hear you talking about policies actually being implemented and this and that, they probably think you're talking about a different world. So what is different about space and what the Trump people are doing that actually is implementing? Is it truly bipartisan and both sides want it? What's happening?
Listen, there's obviously going to be exceptions, and we can talk about some of those, but it has been you know, a bipartisan act of faith for a while that we should have an improved U.S. launch industry, that we should move towards reusables, that we should try to stimulate lower cost access to space, and things like that. And, of course, that's actually happening now. Now, I'm not going to give the Trump administration credit for it happening. It happened because of investments and policy choices made back in the Bush and Obama administrations, and arguably even going back into the Clinton administration. But the fact is that what the agencies are doing is saying, okay, now that we're seeing a dramatic growth in U.S. launch capacity and creativity across a whole range of payload capabilities and different technical approaches and new companies being formed and things like that, you know, what they're doing is actively going and working on fixing the regulatory infrastructure, the processes that agencies use to ensure public safety, to ensure compliance with our UN treaty obligations regarding space, and things like that. And you see agencies in effect competing with each other to see who can be more pro-commercial and more supportive of the economic opportunities created in space. And that's just a great change. It wasn't that commercial space wasn't a goal in the past. It was a goal in the past. And I give full credit to the fact that the industry is, in fact, enjoying this renaissance, enjoying this tremendous growth spurt across so many different sectors. So the fact that it's real and it's actually coming about is certainly helping focus the attention of all these bureaucrats and policymakers. But the fact is that it's always been, you know, to one extent or another, bipartisan, okay? There's been, you know, a few, certainly the Obama space decisions and the mishandling of the FY 2011 budget and things like that, of canceling Constellation, notwithstanding, mostly there's been Democratic as well as Republican support for commercial space. That hasn't really been a partisan divide. You know, some Democratic officials and some Republican officials might want to favor a government-led program in some areas more than a privately enabled program, but generally it's been bipartisan. And what's happening now is that it's really getting implemented. You're really seeing agencies take on the challenges of reinventing themselves for this new world. And that's pretty exciting. I mean, it's not, it's certainly fraught with problems. There's lots of work to do. There's lots of Sturm und Drang and yelling and screaming and gnashing of teeth. You know, it's not like it's all, you know, Susie Sunshine. It's just, it's actually getting done, though. You know, we are actually focused on the right questions. We are actually implementing changes in how various agencies deal with space. And that's just, that's just incredibly fortunate, because it will help make sure that this explosion of commercial space activity continues and even grows in the future.
You have your first email, which is from Ben in Denver, and he says, Jim, I wonder how you would describe the efforts to return humans to the moon. I would not think this administration has done very well, given serious digressions like the Gateway and some of their other plans and no lunar lander. I don't see progress there at all. How do you see efforts for returning to the surface of the moon, or should that even be a goal?
Well, first of all, I have always thought that geography was destiny in space, okay? In other words, it would be really cool if there were a large source of propellant and raw materials for building things close by the Earth in space that we could use to help build space colonies and help build really big spaceships so that we could explore the rest of the solar system and then migrate to the stars, okay? And guess what? There is one. It's called the moon. So we should probably use that. The reason the Obama administration took the moon off the priority list was they actually paid attention to the budget, and they said, well, if you try to build a new government-led spaceship, Orion, and a new government-led heavy lift launch system, SLS, you cannot simultaneously develop a new government-led lunar lander or planetary lander. You can't. They just don't fit under the budget. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to squeeze two things, Orion and SLS, under the budget. Now, they don't fit. And the schedule slips in both programs are a result of the fact that they don't fit under the budget. Now, you can blame that on the Obama administration not giving NASA enough money. You can blame Congress. There's plenty of blame to go around. But the root blame belongs in deciding we needed a government capsule and a government launch vehicle, okay? Trying to do those things kept us from developing lunar surface capabilities. And so that's why the flexible path was never about not going to the moon. The flexible path was about going other places, libration points and near-Earth asteroids and other places first. And then once the launch vehicle was developed and once the spacecraft was developed and they were on, you know, the fixed costs were complete and now we were just paying the variable costs of operating those systems, then you could actually afford to put some capital into developing lander capabilities. But people, you know, in the Obama administration didn't understand or couldn't communicate that message, and we ended up, you know, with policy of walking away from the moon. And the president, frankly, aided and abetted that by saying, you know, we've been there, done that, okay, which was stupid because we hadn't done it. We'd been there, but we hadn't done what we needed to do on the moon, which was to develop it and harvest it. So now, this administration, have they changed the world in terms of NASA's budget priorities? No, they haven't. They have not canceled programs that are underway. The Gateway was already, prompted and already ready to go and actually arguably initiated at some level with study contracts even before this administration came to power. What they did was say, okay, we're going to build one piece of the Gateway. And, oh, by the way, it's going to be based on a commercial platform, i.e. a commercial geosynchronous satellite platform. So it's going to be as cheap and commercial as possible. And, oh, by the way, it's going to be commercially launched. It's not going to be launched by SLS. So that's what they've committed to. Now they're engaged in discussions with partners. It absolutely makes sense for there to be a space station, a crewed or crewable space station somewhere in lunar orbit. Do I think where they are proposing to put the Gateway is the right place? No. It's a Special Olympics affirmative action orbit for SLS. SLS can't get Orion to any other orbit, basically. So it has to be in that distant retrograde halo orbit. An orbit they originally discovered as a place they wanted to bring an asteroid to. But the Gateway will be able to move. Are they necessarily making the Gateway commercial enough? No, they aren't. There should be more commonalities between what's being done for the Gateway and what's being done for commercial space stations at low Earth orbit. The biggest failure right now, and we haven't seen the Space Council act on this yet, but I think they will in the future, is we don't really see a plan for transitioning low Earth orbit to the private sector. NASA issued a plan because the administration finally forced NASA to come up with a third version of their plan that was worth at least printing in bits on the web, and they released a transition plan, but it's not really a plan. It's sort of a statement of some principles and guidelines and goals, but it doesn't say how they're going to do it, and it doesn't really make the choices that they would have to make in order to commercialize low Earth orbit. If there was one big challenge in front of us in NASA exploration and human spaceflight, I would argue it's low Earth orbit privatization and commercialization, because that is going to be how we free up resources and bring more commercial capacity beyond launch into actual human space infrastructure, which will also help determine how we do things on the moon beyond just landers.
Can the private sector lead the way for that, or does it need the government to give us a roadmap?
We don't need the government to create a detailed roadmap, but we need to get agreement that we're going to transition from a government space station to a private space station, and that NASA has to start actually making decisions about how they will acquire infrastructure services instead of operating their own space station. The one unfortunate thing I think that's happened in Congress is you've actually seen bipartisan resistance to the idea of bringing the ISS to a close sometime in the late 2020s, and they're proposing that it actually be extended to 2030, which I think is wrong. Because all that does is take pressure off to figure out how we're going to transition. What this administration did with their budget this year, and it was leaked, unfortunately, before the budget came out, but what they said is, listen, we're going to have it's currently going to, operate through 2024. Let's make the assumption that there isn't going to be a continuation of the status quo in 2025, that we're going to begin to change, and that the current level of support is going to change. Now, people chose to interpret the language they used to mean that suddenly NASA was going to stop spending any money whatsoever in low Earth orbit. That isn't what they meant, and that isn't what they said as they clarified the budget and talked about the budget and defended the budget. But because people were terrified that the space station was going to go away suddenly radically in 2025, we had a mindless, simplistic fight over that instead of a discussion of, well, what can change in 2025? How much can be transferred over to the private sector in 2025, whether it's privatization of the asset itself or the development of substantial enhancements to ISS before 2025 that would be privately owned and operated that NASA could utilize? What could you see done so that we're actively moving towards a commercial LEO economy, well, even before 2025? And that's what was lost. And that fight isn't going away. It's still going to happen. The administration is still going to keep pushing on it. Hopefully some of the ideas that study, you know, companies are working on right now for studies for NASA will make a difference. But we'll see. That's going to be a prime issue for next year. Meanwhile, NASA has started a commercial lunar procurement for small lunar landers. They're having a little bit more problems getting together internally at NASA over the idea that they should partner with the private sector to develop a medium-sized lander or medium-sized landers, because some people in NASA still want to do their own lander. But, you know, hopefully that will continue to, you know, be refined, and NASA will learn that it's not going to build a lot of cutting-edge hardware at anything other than the cutting edge. And while NASA is insisting on building and operating Orion and building and operating SLS, there really isn't a lot of money left over for NASA to have NASA-led projects beyond those.
Do you see getting a bigger infusion than the 19-plus billion for NASA to help them with this? Or?
Well, I think we're actually at almost 20 billion now, but I don't see, with the administration calling for a 5% cut in domestic discretionary spending, I don't see NASA's budget going up a lot from the administration. We may see a small cut in NASA's budget in the FY20 submission that comes out in February, and Congress will probably give some of that back. But Congress isn't going to add multiple billions of dollars per year in 1 year so that NASA can suddenly get out of its current, you know, budgetary limits. It's not going to be able to just escape and be happy with everything and make everything work. They have a real challenge. They cannot afford SLS. And so SLS is continuing to slip. I mean, Congress has told NASA for at least 4 or 5 years that they should be spending at least $300 to $400 to $500 million a year on what's called the exploration upper stage, which is a Boeing-designed upper stage. It's basically an expanded version of the Delta IV upper stage. And it would give the SLS another 20 metric tons of capacity of payload to LEO, and significantly more capacity of payload to cislunar space. They haven't done it. The SLS Block 1 has absorbed most of that money, and NASA is now committed to buy something like 5 or 6 of these slightly lengthened Delta IV upper stages, the so-called ICPS, from ULA, because they aren't going to have an EUS for any of the first initial human flights. So we're going to go to EM4, 5, or 6 with Delta IV upper stages, existing upper stages. And so that means the $400 million that Congress gave them for a second mobile launch platform, because you needed one that was sized correctly for the larger SLS with the enhanced upper stage, is unnecessary. And that money is being spent now at the Cape, but they aren't going to need it. Because they won't. Not only will they not need to have two platforms simultaneously, because they might have two back-to-back missions within a year, you know, one for a Europa probe and one for EM2 or EM3. No, that's not going to happen. There's just going to be launches with the ICPS. So basically, Block 1 SLS is as far as the eye can see. Now, that means that SLS will never reach, you know, until EUS actually comes online or NASA gets smart and decides to adopt the ACES upper stage from ULA, you're not going to have a really good effective upper stage for it, which means they're going to be stuck at 70, 75 metric tons of capacity. Well, New Glenn may get there, okay? Falcon Heavy is already close to that. So why do we need a government-developed heavy-lift launch system that's, you know, that's going to absorb $2 billion a year forever? That's money that could be going into a lander. And as you see these commercial heavy lift systems come online, that's going to get more and more present and more concrete and more real. And I predict, and I predict this with some sarcasm and certainly a bit of a snark, that when we have finished spending every possible fixed cost dollar on SLS, that is when we will actually cancel it. But we will wait until we've finished every fixed cost dollar we can possibly spend on having the capacity of flying SLS, but then we'll stop after we maybe fly it once or twice.
How will they justify the multiple billions of sunk cost and what they've spent on this thing, or will they just blow it to the wind?
I'm sorry, sunk cost is sunk cost. It's already spent. Okay.
Right.
If the marginal cost of using SLS once a year is $2 billion, then why would you use a system, continue to use a system that costs you $2 billion to launch 70 metric tons when you can launch 1,000 metric tons with commercial alternatives for the same amount of money? You wouldn't. No rational person would do that. So at some point, when those other systems come into play and are actually proven and are actually flying, you know, in 2020, 2021, 2022, you know, you will no longer see SLS command any loyalty other than the people who are directly benefited by it.
Do you see any changes in this as soon as the next Congress taking over?
No. I don't see this happening soon. I see it happening over the next few years. It's not going to happen in the next year. I don't see a Democratic Congress coming in and canceling SLS. That's not going to happen if they do come in. Certainly, I don't see Republicans doing that. Until reality changes on the ground, we're not going to see a major shift in what NASA's doing, unless something happens I'm not expecting. So don't sell your Boeing stock. Don't sell your, you know, Northrop Grumman stock. Don't sell your Aerojet stock. Just, you know, at least not yet. You know, everything's going to be fine for the next year or two, but eventually this will come to an end because it has to. Things that aren't sustainable aren't sustained. And sooner or later, it will end. I just wish we could have done the last 6 years the right way instead of wasting as much money, or last 7 years the right way instead of doing what we did. I wish we had shrunken Orion, you know, made it a much more capable system by making it, you know, a smaller command module, possibly added a habitat module to it, you know, for longer term missions. And then used Falcon Heavy and Delta IV Heavy and other systems and propellant transfer to enable early exploration missions to cislunar space. We could have done that. But we didn't, because that wasn't what was important. What was important was keeping the shuttle industrial base happy. I'm sorry, you may not have expected me to get into all this.
No, that's fine.
These are things I can't say normally, okay? And since I'm on here as an individual, not representing any clients or any organizations I work with, I can say what Jim Muncy thinks here, and this is the one place I can say it, and I'm sure people will still give me a hard time for saying these things, but I don't care.
Okay, so
I get to be truthful with you.
Now, I'm fine with it, but I'm going to expand you a little bit with this listener question, okay? So Josh is in Phoenix and says part of how we are We do have a caller on hold, but I'm going to finish with Josh's question. So, caller, please be patient. Josh in Phoenix says, part of how we've been sold on SLS over the years, even with people talking about the budget and tangential issues, is that it's part of our national security issue. So what role does DOD and the Air Force play in the decisions that have been made that you have been talking about and the decisions going forward?
So I am not aware. I am aware of congressional testimony and other, I think, express indications from the Defense Department over the last several years that there is zero interest in using SLS for national security missions.
Whoa. Because I have other people coming on the show that do have credentials, so I assume they're telling the truth, even if maybe their truth is not 100% accurate. You know, one never knows. And they say, you know, this is part of what we need for national security national prestige
National prestige, okay, is a euphemism in their mind, okay, or in my mind, for the government having its own launch vehicle that the government owns and the government controls. Because God knows Elon Musk might go into a Twitter frenzy and lose it, and SpaceX will come to cropper, and we won't have the Falcon Heavy anymore. Because you can't trust those crazy entrepreneurs. And who knows whether or not, you know, Blue Origin can actually build a new Glenn. And who knows whether the private sector can do what the private sector has done in high technology for 100 years, which is reinvent the world. The question is whether or not the government is going to embrace the notion that by partnering with the private sector in a true partnership, where the government isn't paying all the bills of the private sector is at risk. The private sector has money at risk, and they have the idea of the venture they're trying to create at risk. And the government is at risk with some money to jointly develop new capabilities that will enable the government to go places and do things that government astronauts should be doing and wanting to do. But I think national prestige doesn't come from having a big rocket with solid rocket motors. I think it comes from having a big being able to send astronauts interesting places to go do interesting things, as opposed to still most likely in 2020 being waiting for SLS to have its first flight when it was supposed to fly in 2016 or 2017, when it was promised to us back in 2011. So I don't buy it. And people can say national prestige, and they can even say, oh, it's important for our national security. And I absolutely agree that having a strong and vigorous national space enterprise, including NASA, including a civil exploration program that is pushing back the boundaries and going beyond what any private company can do on their own, is vitally important to our national prestige, our national elan, and our soft power around the world. I agree with that. I just don't happen to think that giving a sole source cost plus contract to Boeing to build SLS is the way to get there. So I'm willing to debate patriotic Americanism with any of these people anytime. Now, is there actually a substantive link between SLS and national security? Yes, there is a single substantive link between that, and that is that if you pay the former ATK enough money to build large segmented solid rockets, then they will be able to somewhat lower the cost of non-segmented large diameter solids that they build for the Navy and potentially build for the Air Force for ICBMs. In other words, by subsidizing the producer, and by the way, also subsidizing the producer of the raw material of ammonium perchlorate, you will lower the cost to the Defense Department of making ICBMs, whether submarine or ground-based launch. Now, I would rather write the Defense Department a check that subsidizes their purchase, okay, than go spend $2 billion a year just to have a small impact on the affordability of ICBMs. That's not really a reason. Is it a benefit? Yes. It's a minor benefit. Imagine, for example, if in 2010 or 2011, NASA had done what the Augustine Commission recommended, which was to go invest in advanced hydrocarbon engines. In other words, go do what Elon was already doing with the Merlin and Blue Origin was quietly doing, you know, starting to work on with the BE-4. What if they had gone out and invested in Aerojet engine? What if NASA had gone out and invested in other? Don't you think that would have dramatically helped us develop new national security launch capabilities that didn't depend on Russian engines? Wouldn't that have been a huge strategic benefit to us in terms of our dependence on Russia for the RD-180? Yes, it would have been. But that's not what we did. We didn't decide on SLS or choose the SLS design because of national security. We did it because they were using elements of the space shuttle. The argument made was that it was low cost and low risk because we were using essentially off-the-shelf hardware and off-the-shelf technology. And here we are over 7 years later, waiting years to come before the first flight.
And hardly low cost.
Well,
let's see.
One would argue that, you know, $1.5 to $2 billion a year over 7 years, that you should have more accomplished than the structural elements of the first booster made.
Let's see who your caller is. Hopefully they stayed with us. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Please, thank you for waiting.
This is Marshall.
Hi, Marshall.
And I have totally enjoyed the conversation so far. But when I was out walking this morning, it hit me that SLS has an interesting international diplomacy factor in it, in that as long as we are building expendable rockets, the rest of the world will continue to invest and work with expendable rockets because it's an example to the rest of the world. And it kind of says, hey, go out and build these expendables because that's the way we've always done it. And even the United States is still developing them. So obviously that's better than your government going out there and following the Elon Musk model.
If you're saying that we should spend billions of dollars a year being stupid so that other agencies around the world will also be stupid and not catch up to our commercial sector, no,
yep.
I'm sorry. I don't buy it.
It's an interesting thought, isn't it?
But you know, and snarky as all hell, but I don't buy it. I don't think that that's... I think there is a wonderful set of articles coming out in Popular Mechanics in the November issue. It's probably already out on newsstands, but it's online. And it's talking about, a lot of it's about Elon, but there is a wonderful article written by their space editor, Joe Papalardo, talking about how Europe in particular is terrified.
It's already out, Jim.
Okay, so it's already out. And I saw the article online last night, and the article basically goes through an analysis done by a European analysis firm that basically says, we're screwed. Unless we start doing public-private partnerships the way the Americans are doing, okay? I mean, mm-hmm. It's not like the Europeans don't fund the development of their new launchers. They do.
Yeah.
Okay? It's just that what they haven't done is realize that they need to figure out how to not try tried to create an industry out of whole cloth, but how to use their demand for launch, which unfortunately isn't as large as the U.S.'s demand for launch, and actually partner with industry to go develop, you know, as forward-leaning capabilities as possible. And, you know, because we're the United States of America, and we built most of the International Space Station, and we need to launch, you know, several launches of cargo a year to keep it going, we had this ready-made market that the government could express. Instead of operating the shuttle, it could express the market for cargo resupply commercially. And they had that market, and instead of operating the shuttle at a cost of roughly $4 billion a year, we're, you know, buying cargo services for roughly $2 billion a year. And that's a, you know... That's not a totally fair comparison, because obviously the shuttle could do things like crew transfer that cargo, that commercial cargo can't do, but that's coming along as well. And so Europe has to figure out how to do that. And maybe they have to figure out how to work with the Japanese. Or maybe they have to figure out how to work with American companies.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all sorts of things that they could do in a commercial fashion if they just agreed that that's what they should do, but Kness hasn't made that intellectual leap yet, and until they do, you know, they're going to be, you know, I mean, when the Europeans say that reusables don't make sense, they're right, because they're talking about the flight rate that they are enjoying, okay, which is a very small flight rate. Okay, but as it turns out, you can develop reusability organically with an initially expendable system. Elon's shown us how to do that. Now, Blue is taking a harder job. They're designing in reusability from the beginning, and while their first, you know, few new Glens may not fly, you know, 10 times or 20 times or whatever, they really are explicitly going reusable from the very beginning, whereas that wasn't an advertised capability of Falcon 9 when it came out. But that was not, obviously, that's where Elon was going.
Right. In your opinion, I think it's the Ariane 5 is basically going to get canceled. Have you heard anything along that line?
My understanding is they're intending to replace it with the Ariane 6, because the Ariane 6 will be roughly half as expensive to make.
Ah,
so
but it's still expensive.
They're replacing, I mean, they have the Ariane 6 in development right now. And when that first flies, there will be a transition period. I mean, the Ariane 5 was developed for launching, for dual manifesting geocommunication satellites, you know, as they were seen to be sized, you know, several years ago. And also to meet the needs of launching both the automated transfer vehicle for ISS cargo, and ideally they wanted to launch their space plane, Hermes, okay? So they had a good idea for it, but it was sized for all of those applications. It turns out you don't need that big a launch vehicle, and it turns out that dual manifesting payloads doesn't always work out.
Yep.
So instead, the Europeans have ended up launching some really big satellites that are much bigger than anyone ever thought we were going to be building geo satellites, and doing some dual manifested launches, but you know, the Ariane 6 will not be quite as large as the Ariane 5, but it will be cheaper to make, and that's what's important. And, you know, disruption is really good for markets. Disruption and change is really good. It's very easy to sit around when nothing's changing and just sort of make everything maybe a little bit better, or even make things a little bit worse in terms of more expensive over time. But disruption changes things, and that's what Elon does to markets. That's what people in Silicon Valley do to markets, and that's what's happening now in our space field. And whether it's CubeSats turning into remote sensing platforms like Planet has done, or what Virgin and Blue Origin are doing with reusable suborbital access, or, you know, what Moon Express is going to do with low-cost lunar access, you're just going to see a tremendous amount of change happening as more and more sectors open up to this sort of investment and this sort of approach.
Yeah. Bill, my last point is it still sounds like, even in your current rhetoric, is that almost everybody is still on the expendable rocket plan, and the smart rocket that returns so that you can reuse it is still a minority view looking worldwide.
Well,
do you agree with that?
I think that there are a number of small companies that are developing low-cost expendables for very small payloads because people want dedicated launches of their small payloads.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whether it's Virgin Galactic doing Launcher One to launch OneWeb satellites or other small satellites and Vector doing even an smaller launch vehicle, and of course Rocket Labs just announced that they're going to be operating from the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport at Wallops. So there are a number of companies out there, you know, doing expendables, but cheaper expendables at lower cost with, you know, with 3D printing of components and other, you know, entrepreneurial approaches that, you know, they are not former ICBMs, okay, as the Delta IV is, okay, and as the Atlas V is, okay. Now, obviously, the Delta IV and Atlas V are dramatically improved and were actually both commercially developed by Lockheed and Boeing in the 1990s and early 2000s. So even that approach, even though they were expendable, that was a result of a public-private partnership the Air Force engaged in back in the late 1990s for EELV. The mistake was for NASA to not embrace them and use them for commercial cargo early on as Elon and others brought in new capabilities and use them also for human exploration. Instead, NASA wanted to build Ares 1. And that was just stupid. And if we had used those existing launch vehicles, we could have, you know, ULA wouldn't have to be ULA. You'd still have Lockheed and Boeing competing against each other, and that would have been better for the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's time for me to let somebody else talk.
Thank you for your call, Marshall.
Thanks, Marshall.
So, listeners, Marshall has freed our phone line. If you're interested and would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. And email continues at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you have a note from Sarah, who is up in Seattle. And Sarah says, about the only thing we hear with human spaceflight out of the private sector are the Mars plans for Elon Musk down the road. Is there any other human private space plan activity going on, or are we dependent upon Musk to make that happen?
No, I think that Mr. Bezos has made it very clear that he wants to develop the moon commercially. I'm not going to speak specifically for companies, but I'm aware of other companies that would like to develop robotic capabilities first and then move towards human capabilities for lunar landers. And, of course, Elon is going to fly people on DFS around the moon on a wonderful artistic-oriented flight in 2023. So, or thereabouts. I don't know exactly what the year it is. The paradigm is changing, okay? And while Elon is primarily motivated by turning Earth into humanity into a multi-planetary species by going out and exploring and developing a real planet at Mars, and Jeff is oriented towards using the resources of the moon to help build space colonies around the Earth, There are other visions to be implemented. There are other people with ideas. There are other billionaires who are entering the scene that haven't been involved so far. And, you know, the paradigm is changing, and I would not be surprised if there aren't several other people with large bank accounts entering this industry in the next 5 years. I wish it weren't just people of those means. I wish that we could grow more billionaires or, you know, multi-hundred millionaires organically from space, and I think we will. But right now, it really takes the reality and the financial heft of a Bezos or a Musk or the great late Paul Allen, who we lost this week, or Richard Branson, to basically stand up to the government orthodoxy and the you know, the history of it all being about that space is all about NASA, and doing things on their own, and doing things on their own well enough that NASA begins to work with them, and then they can achieve even more. And that's what's so exciting. I mean, the Air Force issued a few contracts recently. They gave ULA a large contract for development of the Vulcan ASUS new rocket. They gave Northrop Grumman a contract for development of their new solid rocket motor-based system. But they also gave Jeff Bezos $500 million for development of New Glenn. And I think you're going to see, you know, more and more opportunities where Air Force and NASA and other customers really do embrace new offers and new entrants, and because they'll have to. And I think you know, just as SpaceX paid off so much more for NASA with the $278 million they initially gave them for COTS, than the, you know, the multi-billions of dollars that were spent on Ares One, you know, you're going to see the same payoff, I suspect, for the Air Force and for other projects.
You have another listener on hold, another caller.
Shoot.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
I wanted to ask about a few things that have come up over the course of the show. I'm not a person who normally follows the politics and the business of the space industry, so maybe I'm a bit more more medium range for some of the listeners out there. Because this is a pretty sophisticated conversation, and I think I might have to listen to it again. But when I think back to the situation in the economy when Obama first came in, wouldn't there be a certain amount of factor about the decisions that were made back then, that it was a time when any decision to give money to NASA was going to be unpopular because it's very easy to attack politically, because people don't connect it in their mind with something that has economic benefit. And that sort of touches on a whole general theme that, at least I've often interpreted it this way, that programs in space have trouble advancing because it's too hard to explain to an average voter what the long-term plan is, how things build on each other, and it's a very technical area, so it's hard to understand. And it's just so easy to attack on economic grounds that things take more time than they really should. Can you comment on all that?
So, I mean, there's a lot of truth in almost, I think, almost everything you've said. I do think that it's sometimes hard to explain space to someone who doesn't get space and doesn't understand what it's about. But I also think it's wrong to try to sell space based on what are typically thought of as spinoffs or other ancillary economic benefits that come from a large government program. That's not why we should be going into space. That's not why we should be investing in space. We should be investing in space because we want to open up a new free frontier for economic and scientific and cultural development. Because we literally want to expand humanity into the solar system. That is the reason to invest in space in terms of human spaceflight. It's because we want to go live there someday. Now, that's a very strategic, you know, long-term vision. Every time that humans have moved from one part of the Earth to another part of the Earth, and brought, you know, whether it's the Asians who migrated over the land bridge to North America, and created the Native American cultures in North America and South America, whether it's the Europeans coming first to South America and then later to North America, there was progress. Now, in the case of America, there was obviously cost as well, major costs. And I'm not saying that that's, you know, but when biological species go to new environments, they flourish, they evolve, they grow, they adapt, and they move forward, and they advance, and they evolve. And that's what species should do. And so by expanding from the surface of the Earth, with all the wonderful protections of the atmosphere and the magnetosphere and everything else that makes Earth so special as a wonderful planet, there are also opportunities of being bathed in sunlight 24 hours a day. There are also benefits of having low gravity to use to conduct certain industrial processes. There are also benefits to having raw materials lying around in low G fields that you can use to build things. Whether it's the sixth gravity of the moon or free asteroidal materials, in essentially zero G. That's why space is an exciting frontier, because there are things out there we can do that go beyond what we can do on the surface of the Earth. And humans can build homes and create economic opportunities and can discover new scientific principles and have new cultural expressions in the different environments of space. And that's why I think it's worth it for our civilization to expand our civilization into space. Anything less than that is just government employees going and giving us vicarious enjoyment watching them do a few things in a different place. Anything less than migrating our whole species into space, and that's, I'm not saying we leave the Earth behind, I'm just saying that we, you know, expand into space. Anything less than that is just a government program that has whatever short-term economic benefits or political benefits to certain areas and certain states or certain countries, and that's all it is. That's not enough. We need to be thinking strategically in terms of our culture and our civilization. And inside that conversation, it's much easier to talk about why we're doing things in space. It's also easier to judge what decisions we make in space, because either are they really enabling hundreds and then thousands and then millions of people to go into space, or are they just preserving the current status quo? And, you know, By that measure, I think a lot of our current activities are failures, are not going to succeed. But I'm probably an outlier in terms of my view of what we should be trying to do in space.
How about the way the market is developing these days? Because there's so much change, but the traditional launch payloads are changing very quickly. So you have people developing large rockets while the geostationary satellite market is really going down. And where do you see the future of these rockets they're trying to make? Doesn't it sort of imply that we have to undertake very large projects out there? Otherwise, why develop these rockets?
Well, I would argue that the greatest amount of dynamism happening in launch today is not at the large end, it's at the small end. That I think the Tori group did, or I'm sorry, they have a new name, I can't remember what it is yet, off the top of my head because I'm old. I just turned 60 a few weeks ago, so people will have to forgive me. They've done economic analysis, and they've also surveyed the world market, and there are probably 50 to 100 small launch companies around the world that are trying to develop small rockets to launch anywhere between 10 and 1,000 kilograms, or maybe a few thousand kilograms as a range. That's where most of the dynamism is. That's where most of the, you know, churning and new companies are getting started and things like that. And the leading, you know, offers are companies like Rocket Lab and Breakthrough and Relativity Vector and a few others. And, you know, those companies are dramatically lowering the cost and increasing the capacity and frequency and flexibility of launching small payloads by themselves instead of having to launch them in combination with other payloads on, for example, an Indian expendable launch vehicle. So I think there's tremendous dynamism happening there. Now, yes, there is new investment in large payloads because the government still wants to launch large satellites. And while the geostationary market has slowed down and is pausing while it waits to see what happens with the non-geostationary market, the new large constellations that SpaceX and other companies are looking at making, you know, the fact is there's still a demand for launching geostationary craft, and so you have, whether it's SpaceX with the Falcon, initially charged up by the NASA cargo market, but now having won a majority of the global launch market. You've got Blue Origin developing their system, the New Glenn, for a similar market, but also government payloads, and also what they see as an opportunity to go do exploration. Elon's turning around and building BFR and BFS. So he isn't sizing that because of government requirements. He's sizing that because of the requirements of what he wants to go accomplish in space. So he's not basing it on just, you know, the desire to have a big rocket. He's doing it because he wants to lower the cost for really massive transport of people and cargo to Mars or to the moon or to other locations in space. So I don't know, it's going to be interesting. I think we have a rich diversity across different classes of launch, and exactly how it's going to turn out, we don't know yet. We don't know, and we don't know what new entrants are going to come in. It's much more expensive to play at the large end, so there tends to be more government involvement. There tends to be more government partnership and government as a customer there. But I still think you're going to see new entrants come in there.
Yeah, that touches on another thing. Because you made the point a while ago that you wish there was more wealthy people able to enter into the field or willing to enter into the field. How far are we from?
Well, I actually think they are good to enter into the field. I'm not wishing that they would. I think they will. I think you're going to see more billionaire investors see that space isn't just a place for true believers like Elon and Jeff, but you're going to see ones that go into it because it's an area, it's an opportunity to go make money.
Yeah. Okay. So how far do you think we are? What are the barriers to this coming more into the market where people invest through a stock exchange, through those kinds of mechanisms?
I think it's going to happen. I think you're going to see. You've seen some companies depurchased. One remote sensing company was purchased for significant dollars by Google, and then they turned around and sold it as part of a partnership to Planet. I think you're going to see more acquisitions of companies as the market continues to solidify and grow and broaden. I don't know. I'm hoping that the next breakout area is going to be low Earth orbit human spaceflight. But I'm not sure we're even at the beginnings of that yet, because I don't think the policy decision has really been made by both the U.S. government and the international partners in the space station that they want to see that happen. I think it's especially incumbent upon the European government and the Japanese government to decide that they want to continue doing things in low Earth orbit, that they are willing to spend some money on that, while also beginning to spend money on either the Gateway or other things in cislunar space, but that the way they want to participate in low Earth orbit is going to be in a much more commercial partnership kind of way. And I'm not sure that they've figured out how to do that yet, but I think if they do, that they will, they'll spur even more change and even more investment and even more progress. So we'll see. I don't know. I mean, look at NanoRacks. NanoRacks has completely revolutionized the idea of what you would do with a space station by turning it into a way of taking aggregated payloads and then disaggregating them and launching them separately into low Earth orbit to create literally constellations of spacecraft, to use it as a way to, fragment and come up with smaller access to microgravity research environment. I think that and Maiden Space and some other companies are already beginning to show that there are new markets for what human beings in low Earth orbit can do, that don't look like pure microgravity research, which is one of the reasons we built the space station, but may look like more industrial sorts of things, whether it's building space, literally building satellites to spec in space and then promptly launching them from the ISS so they can go off and have a just-in-time nature character for deployment. I think there are opportunities there, and I don't think we've learned all the cool things we can do with low Earth orbit by any means yet.
Interesting. Okay, I'll
for your questions. They're really good questions, and you're much more knowledgeable, and you bring a lot of knowledge of economics and the business world to what you're doing. So please join our industry and help us become smarter.
Well, I'm trying to do that.
Thank you very much, Kim.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Listeners, Kim is off, and you can use the phone. It is 1-866-687-7223. Jim, I'm going to skip a break unless you need to take one for coffee or tea
or
something.
I'm fine.
Okay. You've got another email from Anthony in Los Angeles. Jim, I'd like to know your thoughts about the cost of James Webb Space Telescope, its effect on budgeting, astrophysics research in the U.S., and the effect on the future of cutting-edge tech research instruments.
When you propose a Battlestar Galactica science project and you lie about what it's going to cost, and I'm not talking about any specific individuals or companies or anything like that, but you basically, as a community, you say, we're going to go do this cool thing, but, oh, by the way, we really don't know how to do it. You can literally sink an entire scientific enterprise with the cost of doing it. and you can dramatically delay progress in a scientific field because everything's going into the sunk cost of that one mission. Now, there's no, I mean, I'm not a scientist, okay? But I feel confident that James Webb is going to do things that we've never even really thought about doing before. It's going to pay off in scientific ways that we can't even say right now. And that's what really good science is. And that's what really advanced technology can make possible. But we have to figure out how to do these in more bite-sized pieces that can allow for competing visions of different ideas, different initiatives, different data collection projects, so that we don't just have one program around which we organize our entire astrophysics, space astrophysics enterprise. We've got to be able to find ways to do three or four smaller things at the same time. But there's both a culture and probably an economic and community interest in coming up with these really big flagship programs. The problem is a flagship program can last 2 decades. And by the way, it's not going to last 2 decades in terms of operation. I mean, it's not like Hubble, which fortunately, because it was designed to be serviced, turned out, even with initial flaws, to be an incredibly, incredibly amazing capability. Now, I'm not saying we should launch another Hubble because we now have adaptive optics and other things on the ground that, you know, give us Hubble-class imagery. But there are other things we could be doing that are, you know, perhaps not quite as, you know, too much food for one bite like James Webb was. And I think it's a criminal shame that James Webb wasn't designed to be serviced. I mean, that alone could justify spending on Orion. Not all of the spending on Orion, but if we could use Orion to go service James Webb, wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't that be wonderful? But the spaceflight, you know, the space science community was so, frankly, you know, upset by having become so inextricably tied to the human spaceflight program that they didn't want to have anything to do with the idea of human servicing. And so they went off and built this thing which needs to go farther away from the Earth in low Earth orbit to do its science, but could still have had visits from a human exploration capability. And I don't know why these communities just can't get along and can't work together. But they should be able to. We should be able to do things like that. And that's what an economy could do. Buyers and sellers of goods and services can achieve more than any one company can accomplish by working together. And we don't see different enterprises inside of NASA necessarily doing that, at least not often enough. So, but is James Webb going to be a great telescope? I certainly hope so, and I certainly hope it you know, rewrites lots of textbooks, which it no doubt will. But that doesn't mean it was right to spend essentially like a decade and a half or more of astrophysics development money all on it, as opposed to having other initiatives in parallel going on. Because that I think would have grown more new astrophysicists and actually taught us more in the long run.
Listeners, you can give us a call. The line is free, 866-687-7223. And you have Bob in Kansas City, and he says, what are your thoughts on the necessity for doing projects in space with international partnerships. Don't they cost more and take longer times to do them?
Thank you. Truth emerges from Kansas City. Yay. Yeah. International partnerships don't save money. They don't. Now, a partner, there may be a commercial partnership where you get a supplier or a commercial partner internationally, and they play the role of a U.S. contractor or subcontractor or partner, can, in the sense that, you know, their investment community is helping fund that company and they can help do things. But government partnerships don't save money. That isn't why we do them. We say that's why we do them, but that isn't why we do them. We do them because they create political breadth and political cultural exchange between the nations to work together on big projects together. And the space station is a supremely great example of that. Freedom was initially, you know, intended, you know, initially it was going to be a NASA mission, but very quickly the Reagan administration embraced the idea of bringing in our European and Canadian and Japanese allies in the free world as part of the program. Now, as it turned out, you know, NASA was really didn't have a good idea of how they were going to go about the space station, and so it took a long time before they really got on track with it, really a decade. And the Europeans were actually smarter about it, and the Japanese were smarter about it, and so they were sort of waiting for us to get our act together and finish it. And by the time we were starting to get our act together, we brought the Russians in, which, of course, destabilized everything. But it was still a good idea to work with them, certainly for us to work with them. Whether or not it was good for them to work with us, I think it was. But I know there were trials and tribulations along the way. So I think there are reasons. Ideally, what we should be doing is doing more commercial partnerships internationally. But that's going to require ITAR reform, and that's going to require other governments seeing that they should promote partnerships between their industry and ours rather than state-to-state partnerships. So far, most of our international partners tend to prefer to do it as a state-to-state partnership because they get credibility and they get political capital from partnering with NASA. And I think what they need to do is find ways to grow Elon Musk's in their own company, in their own countries. Because obviously that's what's helped totally transform how we're achieving things in the United States. It's the Musk's and the ULA's and the Bigelow's and the Branson's and others that are dramatically changing how we're accomplishing things in space in the United States. And as I talked about before, the Popolodor story, that's what the Europeans are trying to figure out how they can emulate it. And there's no other way than to grow entrepreneurs and partner with them and help them figure it out. But they can do that. They just have to make that shift in how they do space.
I have another email question, and Karen is in Los Angeles, and she said earlier in the discussion when you started out, you referenced the Space Council. Have they really done much? And also, from the makeup of it and its advisory board, it seems that it's heavily influential toward traditional aerospace, not the new commercial markets. Any comments, please?
Okay, so I would like the user advisory group of the Space Council to include more visionaries and more entrepreneurs, and less what might be called establishment figures. So that's my bias, and that's what I would do. I kind of understand why they did what they did, which is sort of to give everyone that's actively involved in space a stake, and it gave a lot of both existing and new entrants a role in the user advisory group. And there are some very innovative and entrepreneurial people on there. There's one person that was initially named to it but wasn't able to join it because of rules of government process for the members of the user advisory group had to become, many of them had to become what are called special government employees, which have all sorts of additional ethics and legal stipulations put on them. And my former boss, Newt Gingrich, wasn't going to go become a special government employee and have to give up all of his other economic activities just to be on the user advisory group. But so I wish Gingrich were on there and Bob Walker were on there and a number of other smart people like that. One of the things they did was they, you know, restricted any lobbyists from being on there that weren't lobbyists for the organization that was being represented on the UAG. So I think that's a mistake, because I think there's some smart people. Bob Walker, again, comes to mind. Who are lobbyists and aren't going to give up their livelihoods just to be a source of ideas on the UAG. But that said, I think the Space Council itself has done a tremendous amount. I mean, the Space Council is a council of government departments and agencies. It is necessarily an interagency body of departments that have a role in space. And whether it's, realigning NASA towards focusing more on the moon, or Space Policy Directive 2, which is the one I'm most familiar with because I worked a lot on it, which is literally rewriting the regulatory book across many departments and agencies for commercial space activity, or Space Policy Directive 3, which is aiming at creating a new civilian space situational awareness lead agency at the Department of Commerce, so that DOD cannot have to provide all the notifications of impending collisions of space objects to the private sector, and it can focus on its job of being aware of and controlling what's going on in space. And I think you're going to see, whether it's the Space Force thing coming out this week or new or other areas that they're going to take on, I think you're going to see real progress in implementing policy goals, not just writing policy, not just sort of making policy, but actually getting agencies to live up to policy. And that's been the incredibly refreshing breakthrough of this administration and Vice President Pence and Scott Pace and his staff there at the Space Council. They've been implementing policy and getting departments and agencies to implement policy. And so I've seen quite a lot. Would I like them to do more consulting with the emerging sector? Would I like them to be a little bit more pointed towards the future and a little less towards the past? Yes, I would. And we'll see, you know. But it's so much better than what we've had before, with the lack of a true, powerful interagency process for moving the government, you know, literally having a whole-of-government effort at enabling new space achievements. I think it's night and day, and it's a huge change. I don't think there is no way anyone would have predicted that the Space Council would be this active or this results-oriented and this successful just literally over a year in operation. I think it took them longer to get it started than they wanted. I think there's probably, I'm sure there's been troubles along the way, and I'm sure they would love to accomplish some things that they haven't done yet, but I think they've done generally a great job. And I'm not saying that, I mean, I do happen to be a Republican, but I'm not saying that because I'm a Republican. I'm saying that because I've seen things accomplished in this administration that I never thought we would see.
Do you, or does a space enthusiast person have any realistic impact in suggesting or communicating with members of the Space Council on saying, this is what I'd like to see us do?
Well, it depends. I mean, there have been some recently, and there are going to be more public outreach efforts by members of the council or by the members of the user advisory group. So they're going to be going out and talking to communities, space communities, and, you know, just average citizens, I think, more and more over the next year. I'm not aware of the details of that, and I wish I were, and I could popularize them through the show. If I can find out more about that, I'll make sure that information is passed on to David so he can tell people. In general, I always think it's better for policymakers to ask the American people what they want from space policy, what they want their nation to achieve in space. I am definitely a small D Democrat in that response, in that regard, because I think that the reason we are investing funds in space is for the people and for the nation as a whole, and not for the specific contractor or even commercial interests that are involved. So call me a populist. Obviously, you should use your member of Congress if you can, but you should also, if there's an issue about space that you think is important, you should try to find out who in the user advisory group is working on that issue and try to reach out through them. If there's someone on the user advisory group that if you don't have a relationship with anyone or can't, create a relationship with someone, then just write to the chairman and Admiral Ellis and say, this is who I am and this is why I think X and, my arguments, and I'd like the chance to make these arguments to at the appropriate time in the appropriate forum to members of the group and perhaps to the council. Who knows?
In a given year, there are lots of guests who come on the program, and they talk with expertise, so they represent in terms of the Chinese space activities and policy. And many suggest that we should be very concerned and even fearful, and others think it's all an over-exaggeration and we should embrace the Chinese programs and there are absolutely no threats from them. I'd love to know your thoughts on the Chinese and their activities in space, and should we be concerned?
I think China, first of all, China is the oldest nation on the Earth. Okay? Maybe it's questionable whether there are civilizations. I mean, there's certainly the oldest civilization on the Earth. And they think very long term, and I think they are much more Chinese and cultural in terms of how they think than they are, quote, communist per se. Okay, but I think there's also some overlap between the kind of strictures and organization and ways that the People's Republic has organized itself and just their natural inclinations as Chinese, as culturally and civilizationally as Chinese people. And I think they're very serious about leading the planet, period. And I think they're very serious about not only surviving and thriving, but really leading and eventually dominating the planet. And I think they see that space as part of that for them. They absolutely see themselves, as they should, as a great power. They absolutely see themselves as an independent and dominant force for a way that a civilization can be organized and can feed itself and can interact with the rest of the world and both maintain and advance their culture and their interests. Okay? It isn't how I would want to live. It isn't the way I would want to live my life or go contribute to the future of the species or the planet. And that's okay. They're taking their path. I think they are developing capabilities in space because you can't try to be a leader in the world and not be a player in space. You cannot look across the Pacific Ocean and see the United States of America and see how absolutely, inextricably, our military is linked with our use of space. And not say, okay, if space is so essential to how they wage war, we better know what's going on in space, and we better develop capabilities in space, one, that may be able to challenge their use of space, but also assert use of space for their own benefit. And so they're doing all of that. Does that make them evil? Does that make them our enemy? No. It makes them an independent power, an independent nation state, an independent force on the planet that is going to do what it's going to do. And it so happens they have 1.4 billion people and a tremendous number amount of resources. And, oh, by the way, we buy a lot of stuff from them every year. So we're helping to fund their economy. So they have money to spend, in part because we buy stuff from them. So does the fact that they're doing things in space militarily, should it frighten us? The fact that any other nation that is politically independent and may not be aligned with us politically and in terms of our values and our belief in freedoms and our sort of civilizational principles is developing military capabilities in part because we are so dependent upon space, that constitutes a potential threat to our ability to defend ourselves and to defend our interests and to defend our allies around the world. And we have a lot of allies around the world and a lot of interests around the world. We're a global power, and therefore we sort of have to be able to do things everywhere. Not because we're trying to take over the world. Not because we're trying to dominate countries and take them over and rape them and despoil them. I mean, we could do that easily if we wanted to, but we don't do that because that's not who we are. But the fact that China is developing a lot of military space capabilities, yeah, it means something. When Russia launches satellites that apparently migrate from one location in geostationary orbit to another to observe our satellites, is that worrisome? Yes, it is. When China starts developing hypersonic missile capabilities that could literally stand off attack us so that we couldn't operate with our ships in the Pacific, yeah, that's challenging. And so we have to think sort of next generation, what should we be doing in space that will allow us to protect our allies like Taiwan, to protect our allies like Japan? So I'm four square with the people who think that China is a strategic competitor. That does not mean they are an enemy. That means that they're a competitor. They are an economic competitor. They are potentially a military competitor. And they are developing capabilities which they have every right to develop. but we need to be mindful of that so that we can survive and lead and grow and advance just as they are. Now, do we need a space force to do that? That's a great question. And I think there are things we need to be doing in space that we aren't doing militarily, but they don't look like having space marines, and they don't look like having, you know, Star Trek uniforms, and they don't like, you know, all the jokes and sort of, you know, sound and fury around the idea of a space force. Is a space force the right way to organize, train, and equip military soldiers and officers to develop and to operate military capabilities in space? Maybe. Don't know. Don't really have an opinion. I do think we absolutely need a unified space command, and we're doing that. I absolutely think we need a much better way of acquiring and developing new space capabilities than how the Air Force does it. So a space development agency makes a good sense if they use public-private partnerships and take a much more entrepreneurial, less, you know, top-heavy approach to acquisition of space things. But do we need an actual Department of Space as part of a Department of the Space Force, just like we have an Air Force Department, a Navy Department, an Army Department? Or should maybe we have a Space Corps within the Air Department of the Air Force? I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Yes, I think you did.
Your unstated question. But I knew it was coming, so I thought I would go ahead and answer it.
What's happened? You said the Space Force is happening this week. What's on the agenda for this week?
The Space Council is meeting on Tuesday, and I believe that there will be a space policy directive approved by the Space Council, which takes further steps towards the organization of pieces of the Space Force.
Now, that does seem more partisan than the rest of space that you were talking about that is more bipartisan. Is that a correct assessment?
I think the fact that President Trump is talking about it and advancing the idea, even though in the House of Representatives and the Armed Services Committee, there has been absolutely bipartisan agreement between the chairman and ranking member of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee that the Air Force is screwing up space militarily, that they're doing a bad job of developing and advancing American military capabilities in space. And Congressman Jim Cooper is the ranking member from Tennessee, and he completely agrees with Mike Rogers, the chairman from Alabama, about this. So there's absolutely no partisan daylight whatsoever between those two men. And they've been the leaders in Congress in advocating for a Space Force or a Space Corps. But a new organizational unit that has its own budget that isn't subject to the biases of, you know, silk scarf pilots in the Air Force, and that steal money from space investments to fund F-35 or a new long-range bomber or whatever. So, but because Trump is now seen as the person advocating for the Space Force, all of the normal, you know, anti-Trump phenomenon has emerged and is questioning it. And it's unfortunate because I think there really is a lot of good intellectual debate about whether or not a Space Force is a good idea, including within the administration. You know, I think fairly famously, you know, become clear that the Secretary of the Air Force isn't totally on board with the idea of a Space Force, of yielding to a new military department responsibility for space and taking that away from the Air Force. I mean, the president doesn't clearly care about that. And the real question is what should you do and what's the right way to transition from here to there? And I don't think we're necessarily having as enough of an intellectual conversation about that because we get caught up in the Trump phenomenon. But hopefully that's what the Space Council has been doing. It'll be interesting to see what they say on Tuesday. They're going to be meeting over at National Defense University and will be announcing whatever they announce. And I don't know what the nature of what they're going to say is. I'm not privy to those things, but they will be talking. And in the morning, Vice President Pence will be speaking to a public forum organized by the Washington Post to talk about the Space Force. And he's going to give the kickoff speech and be interviewed by the Washington Post. And then there will be, I think, some panels talking about it. So if you go to the Washington Post website, you'll be able to watch all of that on Tuesday morning, Eastern time. And then the Space Council should be broadcast live on certainly via the NASA website and possibly other websites as well. You can go to you can look around on the web and see where it will be shown. But the council meeting itself should be live on the web.
Changing the subject slightly as we come up on a 2-hour time frame. And listeners, if you want to call, that line is still available, 866-687-7223. So Barbara is in Tucson. And she says, do you hear any rumors that are worth passing on about the mission of X-37B and why it's been up there for so long?
I do not know why X-37B is its current mission is. I don't even know for a fact that it's up there right now, but I assume it is because she's saying it is. I'm sure it's doing really cool stuff that's helping us find out what's happening at various interesting places on the planet where we don't normally have satellites looking, but that X-37 can get into a position to observe. One of the things I'm most proud of in my career is that working for Chairman Rohrabacher, I got X-37 its initial congressional funding back in 1998. And then helped advocate for it later, even after I left Congress. So X-37 is a tremendous success story. And just imagine what we'll be able to do when a New Glenn can launch it reusably. So you have a reusable upper stage and a reusable booster.
Well,
you've also seen, I believe it's also now been launched by a Falcon as well. So you're gonna see some really interesting things happen as we have more and more reusable capabilities in space that are going to enable us to know what's going on everywhere.
Will we ever be able to find out what it does or what some of its capabilities are, or is this just really a black project and we're never meant to know?
It is looking at things, and it may be listening for things, for all I know, from places that are not, you know, satellites are in predictable orbits. What the X-37 can do that all of our other spy satellites can't do is maneuver. That gives you the opportunity to get yourself into different harmonic orbits that are looking at different things, different places at different times than you were before. And so you can respond to events on the ground.
It is very cool. It's very cool looking, too. And I'm assuming nobody else has anything like it that we're at least aware of, or that it's not in the public domain. Is that correct?
The Soviet Union were developing things like that. The Bohr 4 is a mini space plane. You know, that dream, I mean, and of course Dream Chaser will be able to do things like that.
Right, but none of the Soviet...
I am not aware of other nations having a similar capability, but that doesn't mean they don't have one.
We're getting close to the end of the year, so is there anything that we should be looking at or paying particular attention to between now and the end of the year?
Well, obviously, the election in a few weeks will make a big difference. There is some important legislation in front of Congress right now that I really wish we could get Congress to discharge and send to the president for a signature. In particular, the House passed a major piece of commercial space legislation early this year, and the Senate has marked up and reported out their version of the bill, which frankly is not as good as the House bill. The House bill is called the American Space Commerce Free Enterprise Act. I'm sorry, I can't remember the net number of it. It might be 3809, but don't trust me. But it would be on the Science Committee website. The Senate companion bill is called the Space Frontier Act that Senator Cruz and Senator Nelson introduced, and they marked up. And what both of these bills attempt to do is streamline the law for remote sensing, commercial remote sensing regulation. And in the case of the House bill, it creates a very, very light touch regime for authorizing and providing continuous supervision of new commercial space activities that are not basically launch vehicles or commercial remote sensing. So it's for all the new commercial space activities that don't necessarily have a home in the federal government for policy and regulatory oversight. They would all be under the Department of Commerce. Basically, the Department of Transportation would handle launch and reentry and those transportation functions that involve public safety of people on the ground, and everything else would be held by the Department of Commerce, except of course for communication satellites being under the FCC. But that's what the House bill does. The Senate bill doesn't go as far as that. But hopefully we could see some resolution between the House and the Senate before the end of the year and get something enacted. Both houses have also passed NASA authorization bills through their committees. I don't know. Well, actually, the Senate bill hasn't gone to their committee yet, but they have been working on it. We'll see. I don't know that we need a NASA authorization bill this Congress. I think we had one at the beginning of the Congress, the NASA Transition Act, that sort of kept the current program of record in place. I think we'll need to see NASA authorization legislation next year, as Mr. Bridenstine enters his first full year as administrator, and he starts to have more of an impact on the budget submission and where they're going. And I do think it was very unfortunate that Mr. Bridenstine's arrival at NASA was delayed over partisan reasons. That was very unfortunate and completely unnecessary. And I think he's already shown that he's a breath of fresh air at the agency. Whether or not he's going to be able to, you know, make the kind of changes I think are necessary, still TBD.
Early next year, aside from election results, is there anything on the horizon that we should be paying particular attention to?
I think what does the NASA budget look like will be critical. The administration's budget will also include some sort of new organizational construct for how DOD does space, because it's going to include something for the migration to a space something or other, whether it's a space force or not, you know, something. So I think the budget will be a really big deal, because it will really be in some ways the first truly new budget of this new paradigm coming out of the Space Council. I think that you'll have new chairs of various committees in Congress. Lamar Smith is retiring from the House. Senator Thune is going to move up in leadership in the Senate, so he'll no longer be chairing the Commerce Committee. You know, Mr. Nelson may or may not be reelected from Florida, so we could see new leadership on the Democratic side of the Commerce Committee. And we'll see who wins and who becomes chairman of the Science Committee, either a Democratic member or a Republican member, depending on who wins the House, sometime in November or December. So we'll know who the slate is for running things before January, but they'll be taking their first actual steps as chair people or ranking members come the new year. And that'll be interesting, and we'll have a new... That may not mean much to most of the your listeners, because, you know, it can be arcane and, you know, the staff change and nobody knows who the staffers' names are. But, you know, hopefully we'll have some visionary people. No matter who wins the House, hopefully we'll have some visionary people in charge and leading on space. So I'm looking forward to it.
Anything we have forgotten to talk about today or should have covered or omitted for one reason or another?
I don't know.
Or that you would rather have talked about or want to talk
no,
about?
No, this has been great, as always. I mean, I really enjoy the dialogue with your listeners and your the people who follow on the podcast. And if people have follow-up questions, you know, people can always send me emails at james.muncy@polyspace.com. And... and I'll try to respond if I can. And, you know, go out and start a company. Get involved. Find a way. Find a way to participate. No matter what you're doing, find a way to play. Because this, as somebody said, you know, when it's raining, get your pots and pans out to collect the water. Our future in space is happening as we speak. And it is being revealed. It is being developed. It is being invented right now. And you can be part of it.
Absolutely. Jim, how about we check in with you shortly after the first of the year and
that'd
see
be
what
fine.
Things look like?
That'd be great.
That should be real interesting, because some of these questions will be known then, and you might have a better handle on where we're headed or what we're going to look like. And
I hope I will. We'll see if I do.
Well, if you don't, I don't know who would. But
I'm sure there's other people who have their fingers more on the dials of things than I do. But I'm definitely engaged in some activities, and you know, I'm dealing with problems right now that, for example, one of the problems I'm dealing with. And I've spent a lot of time on this year, and I'll just spend a couple of minutes on this, but it may be interesting for your listeners. When there are more launches from Cape Canaveral, that interrupts more flights of aircraft from New York or Boston or Washington to Florida. Airlines don't like that. And so there are lots of issues that are happening that are a direct result of the growth of our launch industry and the way we currently manage airspace around launches. Airlines don't like that. They have every reason to not like that. But we don't want to stop launching because we might be interrupting a flight, you know, from New York to Florida. So we have to figure out how to do that better and manage that better. And that involves airlines and space companies working together with both parts of the FAA to figure out how to do that. But that's a good problem to have because we're succeeding.
Are they working together in good faith?
We are trying. I mean, it's sometimes it's two steps forward and one step back, but I think we're making a lot of progress. 6 months ago, I couldn't say that. 6 months ago, there were silly articles on the web blaming Elon Musk for your last flight delay. Okay? Which is silly. Just silly.
Much earlier this year, I reached out to one of the airline organizations from one of those articles, and of course, I reached out several times and never got a reply from them. I would have put them on the show and let them talk about it. But
I think we're past the hysterical, you know, rhetoric that was, I think, there. And I mean, and some of the issues are coming from legitimate concerns. For example, a new spaceport was approved at Front Range Airport in Colorado.
Right.
Which turns out to be 7 miles away from Denver International Airport. Okay? The airline industry didn't understand that the fact that a business jet airport got a approval or sought an approval and then got an approval to be a spaceport does not mean that Elon Musk can bring his rocket to Colorado and launch vertically over the continental United States. They don't understand that that doesn't mean that that's possible. So for all they thought, that you were going to have big rockets with huge delays blocking out lots of airspace right over an airport that is absolutely central to our nation's air traffic navigation network.
I imagine that's a suborbital launch spaceport.
It could be for an air, a jet assisted suborbital launch location. Literally, the only operator that could operate from there is someone with the same design that Rocket Plane had a bazillion years ago.
Right.
Okay? So there is no operator. There's no one is developing that capability. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So there's literally going to be no operations there. And guess what? Even if they were going to operate from there, they would have to get their own license to operate from there on top of the spaceport license. So the fact that a spaceport license was approved basically means that the airport has an economic development thing that they can put on their website and talk about. It doesn't mean that any space is going to happen there. So any space flights are going to happen there. And therefore, there's going to be no interruption of air traffic. But it's taken a long time for them to understand that, and they're still afraid because they're a very large and very competitive industry, which is fine. That's great. And we're working with them. But it's going to take time. The FAA is going to have to fix a lot of how it does air traffic control and how they do tracking of space launches. So it's going to take a lot of work. Very detailed, very, very boring, but a lot of policy and law involved in it, and that's what I work on. So
well,
I wish everyone a wonderful holiday season, starting with Halloween and then the big ones, and I'll be talking to you in early January.
That's right, and I'll probably in December send you my schedule. That's about when I'll publish it. So
great.
Happy holidays to you as well, and thank you for being with us for today.
Take care.
Okay, listeners, see the schedule for the coming week. It's a full week on The Space Show. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Special thanks to Jim Muncy for being with us, all of you who participated. And as always, keep looking up. Goodbye from The Space Show.